the voice of industry. The program which follows brings you dramatic facts which affect your everyday life, your health, your happiness, and is presented by Consumers Information to tell you more about how American industry is working to make America a better place to live in, a better place to work in, under a better system for Americans than any other on earth. The voice of industry.
How do you do, fellow Americans everywhere? Today, across our broad, productive land, the wheels are turning, the trains are clicking over the rails, the trucks are charging over the highways, the forges are blasting, and the mills are grinding as industry moves to make the products that you buy. Listen to its sound. And from the broad panorama of marching industry, I select for the present scene a dramatic, little-known story. A story which began 2 centuries ago and ends in your kitchen. A story without which modern life as we know it would hardly be possible. I'm going to take you behind the scenes of America's great canning industry. Yes, the canning of foods is one of the most important occupations that goes on in our country. Without it, civilized man could not push through the tropics and to the far poles. In time of catastrophe and flood, canned foods save lives by thousands. But I'm getting ahead of my story. Come with me now to the place where modern canning really began. It's 1809, and we're standing on the deck of a British man-of-war as she rolls in the swell of the English Channel. An amazing place for the canning business to begin, you say? Well, perhaps. But off to the south, we hear the booming of cannon. Farther toward the coastline of France, the French fleet is on the run, for Britannia rules the waves, and a blockade is clamped on the whole French coast like an iron collar. England and Napoleonic France are locked in a titanic struggle. At the moment, the armies of Emperor Napoleon are supreme on land. But on the sea, from the deck of this British man of war and scores of others like it, all we can see are English vessels or neutral ships afraid of the blockade. The result is that France is starving. Napoleon, the general who once said that an army marches on its stomach, must have food for his troops. By the time food for the armies and navies ran the blockade, it was generally spoiled. In Fontainebleau, Napoleon sits in his study pondering a way to feed the armies of France. He must think of a way. Suddenly, the emperor is struck with an idea. No sound of gunfire drifts through the open windows of his study. And if we'd been there, we could have heard the pen scratchings on the imperial notepaper. A pull at the bell rope, an obsequious figure advances to take the emperor's decree. In a moment, a messenger rides out of the courtyard at full speed toward Paris. And in the morning, a bell rings at a moderately obscure baker's shop and restaurant on a respectable street in the French capital. It's the kind of bell that rings when the door is opened. And this morning, it rings with a special vigor because a neighbor has dashed through the door with big news. Up starts a proprietor, a genial, intelligent-looking man whose name, and mark it well, is Nicholas Appert. What on earth, man? Nicholas is amazed at his neighbor's excited air. Look, cries the neighbor, thrusting a news sheet in Nicholas Appert's hand. And the chef and pastry cook reads eagerly, attention, by order of the emperor, to the citizen of France who can devise a method of ensuring fresh, wholesome food for the French armies and navies at all times and under all circumstances, a grateful government will present a prize of 12,000 francs. And underneath was the symbol of Napoleon, the beehive, and the imperial N. Nicholas Appert caught on at once.
You mean my experiments? He asked the goggle-eyed neighbor.
He nodded vigorously in reply, and the two of them rushed to a back room where a fire was burning under a great open kettle. Over the kettle was a sort of metal crane which held a sealed bottle in a clamp. In the kettle, the water boiled vigorously.
Now, watch closely, cried Nicholas Appert.
And he dipped the bottle under the water, and a cloud of steam hissed into the air. In a short time, Appert withdrew the bottle on its metal arm.
For some reason which is not quite clear to me, he said to his friend, the immersion of this bottle in boiling water preserves the food indefinitely. That is, if the bottle is tightly sealed. I must go to the emperor, show him my process, and collect 12,000 francs.
Appert had been a chef, a pickler, a maker of jellies and preserves, a winemaker, confectioner, brewer, and a distiller.
To his immense practical knowledge of food, he had added a French feeling for the natural sciences. His process worked. It was shown to the government, and Appert did collect his reward. And that first crude process of steaming sealed bottles of food is still the basic principle of canning, an industry which has changed the cooking and eating habits of the civilized world. Briefly, the secret on which Appert had stumbled is this. Food is spoiled by minute living bacteria. Subjecting the cooked food to high temperatures kills these bacteria. Sealing from the air in a can or bottle prevents more bacteria from reaching the food, and so it will keep indefinitely. Appert put up cooked meat and fish, eggs, fruits, and vegetables in his airtight bottles. And the canning company, which he founded in the time of the Napoleonic Wars, exists in France to this very moment. But it was in our own country, America, that the canning industry became the modern industrial giant, experimenting, improving, exploring that it is today. But first, let me take you to England. The great scientist Sir Humphry Davy has succeeded in superheating steam at the unheard-of temperature of 240 degrees above zero Fahrenheit. And in his shop, a shrewd inventor named Peter Durand is rolling a thin sheet of metal between two heavy cylinders. The result is a thin sheet of steel plated with tin. Durand cuts his sheet into an oblong shape, rolls it again, and makes a cylindrical vessel. He seals both ends and has the first modern tin canister or can. So now we turn to the new world, where American enterprise and ingenuity is to make a great industry from these basic principles. Appert's process, Davy's superheated steam, and Peter Durand's plain tin can. The time is 1821, and the scene is a forest in primeval Tennessee. We're beside a quiet trail where none but the Indian and the deer has ever trod. What's that? Is the twig cracking? Yes, it's a man. Young, tall, tanned, he strides unafraid through the forest. His name is William Underwood, and he's from New Orleans. His destination is Boston, and he's been almost 2 years on the road, walking every step of the way. William Underwood, on this amazing overland hike, had a chance to study the berries and vegetables of North America, for that's how he lived. He ate the fruits of the forest, the wild huckleberries, the pawpaws, and from clearings, he took the succulent Susquehanna corn, paying for it by work around the homesteader's cabin. William Underwood finally reached Boston, and there he founded his business, sterilizing fruits and vegetables such as he had eaten in the open, and sealing them in jars. This was the beginning, too, of the period of the Yankee clippers that sailed around the world, and the sound of the chains as they raised their anchors in Boston, Newport, and Newburyport meant that American seamen were outward bound for China and Ceylon. On such ships, the preserved foods of Underwood and other early New England canners like him would journey to the ends of the earth to give the American shipmasters and men a snack of New England lobster, string beans, succotash, shrimps, clams, and cod. Turkey and chicken, too, went along with the seafood and vegetables. These canned rations were so good that when Commodore Perry opened Japan to Western commerce, the Japanese were so impressed with his New England canned vegetables that they asked for shoots of the same vegetables to grow in Japan. In 1825, the mail coach rattled up the street to Underwood's office in Boston. And a special letter was opened with ceremony in Underwood's old-fashioned office. It came from a colleague in the canning trade, Thomas Kensett of New York and Baltimore. Kensett was going to adopt the tin-plated container in place of glass. Would Underwood consider the same idea? Progressive, the New England manufacturer agreed to use the tin container, and modern canning was an established fact. All this more than 100 years ago. And now came a solid citizen named Isaac Winslow, a state of Maine man. Winslow had seen and approved the canning of fruits and vegetables, meats, sausages, fish, and other foods. But Mr. Winslow liked his corn, and corn hitherto had not been successfully put up in bottles or cans. One difficulty was the removal of the kernels swiftly and efficiently from the cob. Mr. Winslow devised a crude sort of knife and frame which seemed to do the work fairly well. Into the bottles and cans went the fresh kernels of Maine corn, and out of them, later, came the corn in fresh eating condition, most of the time. Early canners had trouble with the distinctly American food, and some trial and error had to be gone through before the canning of corn was a complete technical success. Now let's shift our scene a moment to a chugging early railroad train entering New York City. Two gentlemen with chin whiskers and high-crowned derby hats are seated opposite each other in the sooty smoking car. The time is 1856.
One of these gentlemen is Gale Borden, a man with a tremendous idea buzzing in his head. The other is Jeremiah Milbank, a man with a great deal of money to invest. Mr. Borden's idea is to condense milk by slowly heating out the water till it has reached one-fourth of its original bulk and then canning the residue. Note this Borden. He's a remarkable American type. He's been a farmer, a log cabin school teacher, a traveler. In fact, he's just back from a trip to Europe. The home boys in a slow packet ship impressed on him the need by children for milk on long journeys. His keen, busy mind thought of a way to provide this milk for children and grown people too. Now he's telling Mr. Milbank about it. He met Mr. Milbank quite by chance here in this swaying, high-ceilinged, old-fashioned railway car. Mr. Milbank is convinced. He agrees to back Gale Borden's milk-reducing plant. He figures costs and names prices as the train rattles on toward New York City. One thing Mr. Borden didn't know. Other people had thought of the same idea before him. But Borden's plan was to condense the milk in a vacuum, and this variation finally won him a patent. The condensed milk was a success from the first, and then came Civil War in America. It was supposed to be a short war, and from Washington, the congressman went out to watch Bull Run. The cannon thundered as softly in the distance at first as the guns of the French fleet retreating from the channel. But it wasn't a short war. And again, war gave a boost to the food packing business. Food for the troops was packed in cans, and the canner's business multiplied 100-fold. From that time to the present day, the sterilizing and canning of foods advances steadily, both technically and in the variety of food offered. Today, great areas in New England, the South, the Pacific Coast, and elsewhere are under cultivation for the canner's crop. And where Peter Durand's tin can was made one at a time by artisans, mile-long machines steadily chew out a stream of sanitary containers. Where one man made 60 cans a day, these miraculous machines made 20,000 a minute. A fair index of the vast extent of the industry, which last year filled more than 8 billion cans with food for men, women, and children. The value of this pack was $700 million. But the canning industry of the United States is not standing still. Working with its own research organizations and government standard bureaus, it is striving right now to increase the variety and decrease the cost to the consumer of that prodigious annual pack.
The program to which you have just been listening was presented under the auspices of Consumers Information, an organization sponsored jointly by Woman's Home Companion, The American Magazine, Collier's Weekly, and Country Home Magazine, and dedicated to the principle that the American system of business and industry is the best system yet devised by man for the people of this country. Here's the voice of industry with a word about our next story.
Possibly one of the most beautiful as well as useful products of our time is my subject for the next program. It's plastics. This is Basil Rysdale speaking. Thank you, and au revoir.